Topic session number 20124, Reel 3.
John Anderson, Reel 3.
Anyway, in this casualty clearing station, I had my arm dressed, and I was then asked to, by the doctor, to hand in my pistol. Now, I didn't have an ordinary army issue pistol. I had a German 9mm Parabellum, which actually fired Sten gun ammunition. And I had got that from my father. He had removed it from a German artillery officer during the First World War. And when I was old enough and joined the London Scottish Regiment, he passed me over his 4.5 revolver and this Parabellum. And I had that Parabellum with me at the time. And no way was I going to hand this in. It was a relic to me. And he said, the doctor, well, you can't stay. I said, well, fair enough. So I had my arm in a sling and walked out with my pistol. I mean, this is farcical. I mean, can you imagine the Japanese sort of bearing in mind conventions and so forth in hospitals, not neon Nelly. Anyway, I stood chatting to this other Gurkha officer for a time and eventually left and found a job in one of the sort of defensive emplacements that were being built at the time, because they knew the Japs would be attacking before very long. And it was on that very night that the Japs got into that hospital, and they literally just bayoneted Japs in their beds and shot others and took others prisoner. And we could hear this going on. It was appalling. You could hear the screams. And I can show you the position on the map where that was. And then next morning, as you can imagine, there was a hell of a muddle, and people were trying to get themselves into some sort of useful jobs. And I can remember the heavy artillery, the 155mm guns. I can remember seeing one of those shooting over open sights, believe it or not, at the hillsides where the Japs were sat on the top. And it was all a bit hectic for a few days, as you can imagine. And then eventually, when it was when air supplies came in, when obviously the Japs were having second thoughts and were cooling off, we managed to break out of that box, and those of us who had other units to go to, we found our way back. I was taken back to brigade headquarters in one of the Dragoon Lee tanks. And well, that was the end so far as the admin box fighting was concerned. And eventually, the Nuckydawk Pass was reopened, and then we went into onto the offensive from then on, and the Japs were already on the run, and we were pushing further south. Because there was, several miles further down, a metalled road running east and west between Mong Dor and Butidong, small towns down there, and that's where the Japs were, and we were intending to push them out, but were prevented to when they attacked us. And then eventually we managed to take that road, and it's interesting because there's a tunnel that ran from one side of the range of mountains to the other side, and they used to keep field guns in the tunnels, and then just bring them out, fire a few rounds, then push them back in again. So that, but by the time we got down to a bit of counter battery fire, they were deep underground. I remember seeing those tunnels, and I found it fascinating.
And then?
That was a rout so far as the Japanese were concerned, but things were getting very hot up in northern Burma, and we had been in touch with the enemy for at least a year continuously. There was no let up at all, and I know the whole division was obviously wanting a bit of a rest, but that wasn't to be, because the Japs were massing up north, and the next thing, 7 Div and 5 Div, we were very close together, those two divisions, and we knew a lot of each other. 5 Div was on one side of the range, and 7 Div was on the other side. And I think it was... we weren't transferred north complete as divisions. 33 Brigade went to Kohima. I think there were eventually up in the Kohima area, there were 3 brigades eventually, and another 3 were at Imphal, but they were a mixture of the two divisions, if you follow me. I don't know the reason for that, but obviously there was something necessitated that. And then, so far as 33 Brigade were concerned, they really had some hard fighting up at Kohima. And once again, in my capacity as brigade transport officer, I didn't fly up, of course. I took a convoy of vehicles about 700 miles from the Arakan right up through the hills to through Shillong. Shillong, interesting village there, next door to Cherrapunji, which has the highest rainfall in the world. Anyway, the weather was all right while we were there. And then, so I arrived at Kohima. I wasn't involved in the actual fighting, but that was going on when I got there. But the 4th First Gurkhas, they were magnificent up there. They really were in Kohima, their efforts. Hesitate to say this, but when the panic started up in those areas, they brought an all-British division in, 2nd Division. And they came across India, and their attitude, I'm afraid to say, was get out of the way, we'll show you. And they caught a packet. They made a lot of mistakes. And after that battle, the divisional general had a change of job. And as I say, I'm only sort of expressing thoughts now. I know I'm not alone here, and I have friends who were personally involved, but it was a shame that we had, as I mentioned earlier, this wonderful sort of fraternization between a Gurkha, a British, and an Indian battalion in one brigade. And two div, they couldn't speak any languages. In one instance, the Gurkhas were referred to as coolies, and that blood-boiling sort of atmosphere where you get, because those of us who served with Gurkhas had nothing but admiration for them. Incredible men. They really were.
Who referred to them as coolies?
Well, put it this way, a 2-div officer thanked one of our company commanders for the help of his coolies. The 4th First had gone in to help one of the battalions, 2-div, who'd been pinned down. And a Gurkha can carry a hell of a load on his head. And this 2-div unit was short of ammunition. And these Gurks were, I mean, they go up and down hills just as though it was a bit of a flat level run. Incredibly sure-footed. And they took ammunition up, and that was when they were thanked as coolies. Another interesting thing there, early on, when, as I say, both sides were prodding each other to find out where you were and who you were and that sort of thing, the object was to try and get some prisoners. And a Gurkha patrol went off and came across a party of Japs washing and shaving by the river. And they went and ran amok amongst them and came back and provided the brigadier with a sack with two heads in it. And what the brigadier mostly wanted was at least one with a head on, so be good to question him. Anyway, that's one of the little things that you remember. And the other thing I remember, again, it was this was, I can't quite remember where it was. I know it was an uncomfortable spot. And it was April the 5th, which was my birthday. And we'd had an air supply drop, and amongst the supplies were 1-gallon jars of 100-proof rum. And the idea was, of course, that that is broken down and distributed as a rum ration. But I got hold of some of this and had more than I should have done. And, of course, we were all living in slip trenches then. You daren't spend the night on the surface. And when I woke up the next morning, my little Gurkha orderly was sat at the top of my slip trench there, cross-legged and his rifle across his knees. And when I woke up, he said, well, now it's my turn to have a sleep. He sat there all bloody night there. And I was in, you know, a bit the worse for wear.
Did he get his sleep?
Oh, indeed he did, yes.
What was his name?
Gambir Doge. GAMBIRDHOJ, Gambir Doge Limbu, 15823. And I've been trying to get in touch with him. But I think he See, later on, when all this was over, the Indian army, well, the Gurkhas in particular, were given three options: either to be demobbed, or could join the Indian army, or could join the British army. By the time the actual division came, of course, a lot of them had forgotten what they'd chosen to do, but it was a muddle, and I can't remember the actual units now which went to one or the other, but I know my orderly ended up in the Indian Army, and he got involved in the fighting in Kashmir after the war. And I've got an idea that's where he was killed. But I've got letters from him, and I've been in touch with the authorities in Kathmandu to try and find if he was still alive, but afraid not.
So what do you remember happening next to you?
Well, then, yes. After the Kohima battle, there was a bit of a rest for, I can't remember for how long, but I know it was all a bit peaceful for 2 or 3 weeks probably. And I don't know how this reached me, but I got a note asking if I was interested in becoming an air liaison officer with an RAF squadron, because they were in the process of training a whole batch of us prior to an air and waterborne invasion of Malaya, which fortunately, of course, never took place. But I left the brigade.
So you accepted that?
Yes. I left the brigade whilst they were still in the Kohima area, and flew. Just trying to think where I flew from now. Maybe I got as far as Calcutta. Anyway, I went up to. Forgive me. Do you want to switch off?
Don't worry. Which rough area?
Near Rawalpindi.
That'll do. That's all right.
Yeah. On a course. It was north of Rawalpindi, and I got there and found I was amongst about a dozen of us, and the all had been serving with fighting units. That was one of the requirements, and we were to be attached to various RAF squadrons, some with fighter bombers, others with transport, but mostly we were there to go to transport battalions, squadrons, I mean. And that course lasted about 3 weeks. And then I was posted to an airfield called Chaklala, which is just outside Rawalpindi, and did a parachute training course, because they also wanted an air liaison officer with parachuting experience, because the parachute training school was at Chaklala. And I thoroughly enjoyed that course, met a lot of very nice chaps, all different regiments, and then we came to appointments to various squadrons, And down I went with malaria. I'd had more than my share of malaria and dysentery over the years out there, and this struck at the wrong time, and much to my chagrin, I was never appointed to a squadron. The job I got eventually was the air liaison officer for the airfield at Chaklala, and that was a most interesting airfield, RAF airfield, because they trained people there as glider pilots, air dispatch of goods, you know, transport aircraft and that sort of thing, and air supply of goods. The Air Transport Development Centre, that's right, Air Transport Development Centre was there. And the people attending those courses were representatives, usually of major ranks, from all the various arms of the service. There would be someone who was a signaller, another one who was a doctor, another one who was an engineer, and so on. And the idea was to work out methods of transporting equipment relative to those arms. And I remember even seeing mules dropped from an aircraft, believe it or not, and certainly jeeps. All along, parachute training was going on at the same time. They were turning out about 100 paratroopers a week. It was a fantastic organisation up there. The course lasted for 2 weeks, and two courses would overlap by 1 week, if you can follow me. And the idea was that your first week you did ground training, you know, PT and that sort of thing. You were taught how to fall and so on. You were given a certain amount of air experience. You were taken up in Dakota aircraft, just because an awful lot of people never been in an airplane in their lives before, particularly not Gurkhas and Indians. And also, there's a lot of gymnasium work on mats, learning how to roll and so on and so forth. And they'd have the fuselage. It was an old Vickers Valencia they had on the airfield there, and that was just a fuselage set up on props, and you had to clamber up into that and practice coming out through the door, just jumping out of the door. And then you were shown how to pack parachutes, although you were never expected to pack a parachute. That was all done by the RAF personnel in this country, mostly by the WAFs, but over there it was all the British other ranks. And then the second week you did jumps. You carried out 7 jumps in 6 days, and on Thursdays, I remember, you had 2 jumps, and one of those was at night. And the dropping zone was about, only 2 or 3 miles from the camp. So there were trucks there waiting to bring you back and that sort of thing. But as I say, parachutists were being trained at a rate of 100 a week there, Gurkhas and British and Indian. And a lovely little story of a Gurkha paratrooper there. Two stories, both of them meant to be true. One was of a party who was being talked to by their British officer about becoming a parachutist. And this lad was inquiring as to how high was the aeroplane when they jumped. And he was told something about 600 feet, and he didn't like that idea at all, jumping 600 feet out of an airplane. But they also went on to say, well, your parachute opens and then you land comfortably. And his reply was, oh, well, if I've got a parachute, I don't mind doing it. Well, that was a story that was going around. So I can't vouch for its authenticity, but that was one. And another one, which I did experience, when you come to think that an aeroplane, those Dakota aeroplanes, they held 20 parachutists, and the seating was down the length of the fuselage, not across it. And so you had 10 people facing 10 people. And you all jumped out one after the other. You had a jump master at either side of the door sort of counting you out. When you think that they could land, they could clear 20 parachutes out in 15 seconds. So that's pretty fast moving. And there was one little Gurkha used to sit on the floor of the airplane in the doorway and then push himself off. And of course that's bloody dangerous because the chap behind him could well trip up over the top of him, you see. And it was explained to him, why do you want to sit down? The idea was he possibly thought he was a bit nearer the ground. But then when he was told that, well, standing up and taking one pace forward, you soon get past the doorstep, and he saw that. Oh yes, yes. Well, I don't mind. He never did it again. Those little things come back to one in over the years, and so eventually, I was. My tour of overseas service came to an end there. I was air liaison officer on the Chaklala RAS station for about 18 months, and I came back, landed in this country in January 1946, having gone out in February 1942.